So we should go sequentially. File system virtual appliances. Yes, Sajeev, that's So just to recap everyone's memory, what we do is summarize the key contributions of the paper and then walk through your reviews. You don't have to explain the entire paper. Yeah, and then you know, at some point you should say how you rated the paper.
Okay.
And then the secondary reviewer will finally, you know, if something's got missed out, they should jump in. Okay, Sajeev.
And the scribe.
Yeah, secondary reviewers should scribe.
Sorry, I can scribe.
I'm scribing this, right?
Should yeah, I? You are mine.
Yeah, so I'll scribe this. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so the paper. Okay, the paper, this file system virtual appliances, the third party file system implementations without the pen. It proposes a solution to the problems typically faced by the third party file system developers. By third party file system developers, they want to mean that those file system developers that are not familiar or not in the part of designing the core kernel. So you're just taking file system as a separate entity and putting those on the top of another kernel. So what are the typical problems you usually face is that the porting problem. So that the thing is that when you change, the OS developers change something in the kernel, you have to change the corresponding thing in the file systems. So file system developers have to track the changes made in the new OS version and do the necessary changes in their implementations to get the implementation, to get the interface compatible. So what these folks suggest is that instead of doing that, we'll use the virtualization technology to come up with some solution that will provide some benefit for the third-party file system developer. So you don't have to implement, you don't have to change your file system as the OS version changes. So what they suggest is that use virtualization technology, they use Xen. So you run the user preferred operating system in a VM. And you run the third-party file system in a separate VM. So what it will do is that all the file system communications will transport from user VM to the file system VM using some proxies or RPC mechanisms or some technologies, some shared memory technologies in Xen hypervisor. So in this way, they did some experiments to prove that even when the OS version changes in the user VM, you don't have to change the corresponding thing in the file system VM. So that's how you alleviated a lot of problems that typically third-party file system developers face. So this is the main summary of the paper as a whole. So my rating for the paper is that I give it a weak accept, and the reason I did this a weak accept because they use some assumptions that I find it difficult that it should be there. For example, they use a typical hypervisor technology like Xen, and their solution is dependent on how Xen performs those RPC mechanisms or how those shared memory systems they operate, the Xen operate. But my question is that when a user prefer their OS, they also want to prefer their virtual machine, virtualization technology as well. So you don't have the file system developers don't have the priority to choose the virtualization technology. So you have to change your implementation based on your virtualization platform you use.
But you have fewer virtualization solutions than you have OS versions.
Yeah, but they also assume that the
this technology is dependent on one typical version of a virtualization technology. So even when you use VMware or even when you use Xen, for example, the Xen hypervisor changed to 3.1 to 3.2, you don't know what it may changes their RPC procedures or shared memory system. In that case, you have to change the proxies again. So that's, I think, the main design problem there, their design choices. And another thing that they want that to proxy to be maintained by the WAS vendors. So that's another thing I do not agree.
You want to talk about the proxy, or maybe I don't know if everyone has a copy of the paper.
Okay.
Take a look at that.
Maybe I will give him the picture. Just
okay.
So in this figure too, they talked about their mechanism is that all the VFS calls are handled by the user proxy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the implement, the user proxy. And this user proxy will transfer the corresponding VFS calls to a FSVA
mm-hmm.
proxy in the file system virtual machine. So all the subsequent file handling mechanism will be handled by this VM.
All those VMs are local or they're distributed?
In their implementation, they're local. Because it has to be local.
Mm-hmm.
Because thing is that they talk about migration as well. So when you migrate the virtual machine, you have to migrate both the pair, not one at a time.
So you have to migrate this one and this one?
As well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Yeah, and they say that this user proxy has to be maintained by the OS vendors.
So that seems a lot like NFS or something like that, right? So what? Like network file system. Because it's after the BFS.
And with RPC, then... Yeah.
I mean, what's the...
Sorry?
What's the difference between this and some network file system like NFS?
Yeah, so NFS would operate in a very similar way. NFS would operate in a very, very similar way.
Well, besides the migration part, I don't see a major difference.
Well, also NFS has different semantics, consistency semantics are different. So I guess what you're saying is that why not use NFS instead
mm-hmm.
of what they're doing.
Yeah, coming up with.
So they actually say that this could be a client for an NFS in an NFS like environment. So do they discuss about NFS and the related words?
No, I don't think so. It's the same.
We probably do. Now, the NFS is different in that with NFS you go through explicit networking stack and all that. So in this case they are talking about native communication using which...
Well, but in networking... in NFS you're just using our RCP?
RPC.
RPC.
RPC. And here they use RPC also.
Yeah, but with NFS, these are two different machines on a network.
But
so
it
you
could
have
be
to
the same.
No, how can you set it up like that?
I mean, you could, as if these are virtual machines, you could also...
Yeah, I don't think that's the main difference. I think
okay.
The main difference is that... They have all the data managed by managed within the proxy itself. So that's one difference. So the data is not transferred into the user VM. They have some sort of
well, that's weird. At some point, you have to transfer. I mean, if you're reading a file here, you have
you
to transfer.
Transfer you just transfer
the
pointer.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But that's not the main difference either. Trying to remember what
It's confidential.
So we have another set of related work at the end. But you have, even if you use NFS, you have the same problems as before, which is that you have to, I guess what you're saying is that NFS, now the problem with NFS compatibility comes up. I mean, can you use an NFS version XYZ on the server side and a different NFS version on the client side? Because the third-party file system is being developed for a specific operating system version. So
the problem is that I didn't understand the problem well.
You didn't understand the problem?
No. I mean, probably because... Yeah. I understand is that, for instance, they have this file system in some weird architecture, and some weird machine.
No. It's the thing is that they pointed is the compatibility between the OS kernel distribution and the file system.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the OS semantic changes in some callback mechanism or virtual memory handling or caching or some inode structure. So you have to change accordingly to the file system. So if you have a file system implementation, to put it at a more high level, if you have a file system implementation that you need to maintain across multiple versions of the kernel. So each time the kernel version changes, something about the kernel change might affect how your file system behaves and the implementation of the file system. So you have to port your file system to every successive version of the kernel. And since the third-party file system, the kernel developers will not maintain it for you. So you have the responsibility of maintaining your own file system to keep it compatible with newer versions of the kernel. So they want to completely avoid that problem.
Okay.
And the idea is that if you have virtual machines, then what you could do is you could run your third-party file system in a VM which has, let's say, 2.4 kernel.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a user, the VM with which the user interacts could be anything. I mean, it could be the latest 2.6 kernel.
Yeah.
And it could keep changing.
Now, what is the motivation to use
2.4?
The first VM. Why do you need that?
Because users might want to run the latest kernel for their applications.
But they can run that in the local machine, right? Or no?
So in the local machine?
Yeah.
This is all local machine. So there is a VMM.
You just have some VM that manages for...
Yeah.
I understand that. That's the second virtual machine. But if, let's say, I don't know, if I set up a, for instance, a workstation with NFS as right? Then I can, with the kernel 2.4 and some file system that now is not supported by 2.6, then I can mount from my local machine, let's say domain 0, right? I can mount the exported file system of the VMware.
Yeah. I mean, NFS is a protocol. I mean, right? So you have NFS version something version
exactly.
X, and you have NFS version Y here.
Yeah.
Because these are two different operating systems.
So no, but NFS is the same. It's a standard protocol.
Yeah, it is a standard protocol, but you still have to maintain version compatibility. I mean,
it's the same. They're doing the same, but with a program that they created. So the compatibility is their program. They have to implement it in different version of OS.
That's true. I mean, that's the point. But so which means that what you're saying is that the problems that they will have will be similar to the problems that need to be addressed when you try to use a different version of NFS
mm-hmm.
server and a different version of NFS client.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's certainly true. That's one of my comments as well. So what you're saying is that why not just use NFS?
Yeah, exactly. Come up with a whole Because you have the same problems and
yeah, so I think I'm somehow missing the main point of the paper, which is does NFS uses a user level file system?
There are some clients that are user level, but it's normally kernel level too, for performance reasons.
They use something in the that typically to alleviate this problem. There are some user level FS implementation.
User level NFS.
NFS.
Well, the NFS normal.
Right. No. Normally, I think it's kernel level.
Yeah.
For performance reasons.
Because my
point here is novelty. I don't see.
I think there has to be some distinction between the functionality that NFS provides and the functionality that they provide with their interface, and how that interface is different, right? And why it should be different in their case than what NFS provides. So I guess one of the things is that they want to make these two VMs as a unified, right? So it's not a fundamental difference, but they want to account and manage these two VMs as a single VM. So which means that any memory that gets allocated in this VM and this VM should be controlled as a single whole. So you need to account for both pieces of memory together. So Sajeev, what do you think? I think there is certainly an important point with NFS and how this is different.
Somehow the point they compared that the user level file implementation, they use NFS structure to overcome this problem, but they say that this user level file system implementation has some drawbacks.
Yeah, but NFS is not necessarily user level. I mean, NFS is all inside the kernel. I mean, it could be used with a user level file system, but NFS itself runs inside the kernel.
But the thing is that's the compatibility. There is no compatibility issue with NFS.
I mean,
you will still have the same compatibility issues here.
I guess in their case, I mean, for instance, they could build a Windows machine possibly that runs
now. But right now they are not using Windows file system because the VFS semantics should be compatible. So the Windows VFS semantics is not compatible enough.
That's true. But they also said at some point, I remember that. They want to build a VFS semantics that can encompass both Windows and POSIX semantics. So which means that if you are running some Linux machine here and a Windows machine on this side, you could actually make them both talk. But that's really a protocol issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for instance, we have something like Samba on the Windows side.
Yeah, and you can still run an NFS server on Windows.
Yeah, that's true. I think I'm missing something very fundamental here, but I just cannot point it. As I wasn't thinking about NFS while I was reading this paper. I wish I had. But I still think that there is something different about what
I mean,
they're
right now, the only different thing that I see is what Sajeev pointed out is that If you could use shared memories and they're both in the same machine and just transfer a pointer without copying data.
Yeah, but that's not a fundamental contribution, right?
Yeah, I mean that's just an optimization because they're both on the same machine.
Yeah, it's an optimization. So that's I don't consider that as something which would get this paper accepted. What is the time?
25.
Yeah, we should probably be moving on, but I think, Sajeev, this is something that you need to follow up on as well as I, and address the question of, you know, what is the contribution beyond NFS?
Okay.
I mean, except for some optimization. Are there any fundamental differences with what NFS provides? Okay, let's talk about the next paper. So that's, I think that's important to resolve. Let's just see, if this question is not addressed, then this paper does not stand at all.
And then it should be weekly data.
I mean, it would probably be even reject, just plain reject, because if there is no contribution beyond NFS, then it just becomes a bunch of optimizations for inter-VM communication. And, you know, well, there is some contribution when you want to synchronize the simultaneous movement and migration of two VMs, but that's not something which...
Or unified buffer cache.
Yeah, but those are, I don't think they are... fundamental contributions. They're just simple optimizations. Yeah, okay, so let's move on to the next one, which is the next paper.
RIB.
Okay. Recoverable independent block devices. I think other than what you were saying, there were still some other issues, but I think the NFS issues...
those are, I think, detailed issues that we already figured it out, I guess.
Yeah.
So you gave it a one?
We just did.
Okay. Recoverable independent block device.
I think you want to make a
weaker. Yes, I did. But I'll have to revise that in taking NFS into account. Okay, so... So yeah, so the idea behind this paper is that they want to build a distributed block storage which has ACID properties, which are more like transaction properties. Atomicity, consistency, isolation, and durability. So, and the motivation behind doing this is that file systems have operations that need to be performed atomically. So, for instance, if you want to create a file, there are several data structures that need to be manipulated atomically and written to persistent storage atomically. And they basically, the authors claim that because this abstraction does not exist at the block layer, file systems become much more complex because they have to manage all of this, you know, consistency issues on their own. So their goal is to provide this sort of strong transaction semantics at the block layer. And also, beyond that, they want to provide distributed block storage. I guess, and with versioning and replication. So they want to add these other nice.
So it's like two independent things, right?
Yeah, it seemed like a collection of independent ideas. The key idea was, well, I want to make this transaction block layer. So it turns out that when you take each of these ideas apart and look at them in isolation, they are not new contributions. So for instance, in way back in early 90s, actually, there were a couple of papers on how to make block layer export a transaction interface to the block layer. This is work from MIT. And they basically, they were only doing this for local storage. So it was not distributed storage. Have some sort of start transaction and end transaction. Mm-hmm. So you specify these markers to the block layer, and then the block layer will ensure that these operations are either performed atomically or not performed at all. So you know, use some sort of logging mechanism. So you write everything to, say, let's say, you know, what we now know as a journal. You write it, write everything, these, all of these operations, in a log, and then later on checkpoint the log to static storage. So that idea already exists, right?
That's a nice idea as well.
That's a nice idea, right? So
I'm surprised.
Yeah. So I mean, if you think about it, it's very interesting because then file systems can just say, okay,
right,
start transaction, do all the I/O operations that I want to do, and then end transaction, and then the block storage takes care of everything in the back. And this idea is sort of similar, has some similarities to patches in the work that we saw again. No, that was from UCLA, I guess. Generalized file system dependencies. I guess you were the one who were reading this paper. Yeah. So there, they basically also specify the file system can explicitly specify dependencies, and then the block layer is automatically going to enforce those dependencies. But I guess it's not the same. It's slightly different. It's not about atomicity in the patches work, but more about, well, delegating some of those responsibilities to the block layer. So that the transactions is something that existed from before. So if you want to do this for a distributed storage now, there are new problems because you don't have a single disk and a sequential log on a single disk. You have multiple storage devices. The primary copies of these various items that you are modifying in a transaction may be distributed. So what sort of techniques are required to implement transactions in a distributed setting? So those are the kind of things that they explore. So that's one. Second is about versioning and distributed consistency. If you take just versioning alone, that work already exists. So, well, how do you keep track of versions and make dynamically create new versions of blocks? So that's fairly straightforward, and then that work exists. And if you want to look at distributed consistency, that work exists as well. In fact, distributed consistency work is stronger than the consistency that they provide in this. There is Byzantine fault tolerance storage work on that that's already exists, which is provides stronger guarantees than what they provide. So the contribution, as I see, is that they bring everything together and build one system. So bring existing pieces of techniques together and build one distributed system, which creates some new problems because you need to address, for instance, atomicity in a distributed environment. So that's sort of what this paper is all about. My rating is a weak reject, and thing is that the main contribution of this paper, in my opinion, is making atomic transactions in a distributed environment. That's the main contribution. But as they explain their techniques, there are a lot of details that are missing. And, for instance, they talk about choosing a block size. The choice of how you determine block size and is this, at some point they say, well, the block size can vary and so on. And that sort of, the details on how do you choose a block size and how do you configure the block size, that is sort of missing because and that's important because the locking granularity is a block. And so that's one of, the basic things that they do not really talk about. So it becomes very hard to understand the rest of the techniques that they describe. It is not even clear that who is responsible for guaranteeing that the environment is deadlock free. So So there is sort of there are two primitives that the block layer provides in the main contribution. There are other things like versioning and so on, which I'm going to ignore for now. But to provide atomic transactions, there are two primitives. One is the transaction begin and end, so you can the file system can specify. The second is locking a block. Okay, so that file system can lock a block. You need to lock a block because you might have two threads which might modify the same directory or the same inode simultaneously. So you need to have locking primitives there. Atomicity does not ensure mutual exclusion. Atomicity just means either all of it happens or none of it happens. But you still need mutual exclusion in addition to that because two threads might modify the same file at the same time. So you still need to lock that inode, you still need to lock that directory entry before you do any modification. Both of these primitives are provided by this RIBD. But the problem is that it's not clear how, for instance, deadlocks are avoided, and how who is the one who's managing the locks, because locks are a fundamental unit of arbitration in this storage, and they nowhere talk about how locks are managed inside the RIBD. So that was one key problem that I had. In the file system, do they still need to ensure that they obtain locks in the right sequence? Because I guess only the file system can do that. Or does the block layer automatically detect for deadlocks and so on? So.
And also, I have this point. If you have a lock and the one that has a lock, that.
Yeah.
So those are some of the issues that are not addressed. And the second thing is that this is a distributed storage. It means you don't just have to address one client. You have many clients who are, you know, sharing that storage, and they all share a lock. So there has to be a central lock manager somewhere that's going to, you know, allow acquiring and releasing of locks. It's going to manage locks, but there is no discussion on how that's done. So there are other details which are very hard to understand. For instance, they say versioning is, we have versions, but they don't talk about, well, how versions are created, how they are managed, how they are used. So the details are very scant. They talk about garbage collection. The garbage collection automatically identifies which blocks need to be garbage collected and does the garbage collection. So that's all.
Magic.
So it's like a magic, exactly. So I think the main problem that I had with this paper was that it seems like they have something interesting going on, but the writing of the paper is very hard to follow. And because it misses some of the very important details. And so it's just, you know, I'm trying to imagine some of these details. It's very hard for me to keep track of what I imagine and what is in the paper, right? So it has to be all in the paper and not a combination of what's my imagination. And oftentimes I have conflicting ideas. Well, if that is true, then how was that previous thing? And so it has to all be laid out nicely in the paper, and that's part of the problem. And they say that client-side caching, so if you have clients that are accessing servers, they say that, well, we do not support client-side caching because it's bad for consistency. But it's good for performance, so you should somehow address that problem, because each time I want to access something, if I have to go to the server, that doesn't make sense at all. I mean, there has to be some way of allowing caching to happen at some level, right? So they say, well, client caching is not at all allowed. Those are some of the problems. I think another big problem is that the evaluation is just about performance. So it's just saying, okay, here's our system, and they evaluate against GFS and PBFS too. And they implement a file system called 0FS on top of this distributed transactional block mm-hmm. layer, and ZeroFS is very simple. It just does some things, and even there are some problems in how the details of ZeroFS are specified. So I really don't understand everything about what ZeroFS does. But the problem really is that they need to be evaluating. Yeah, the main thing that I see is that first they need to evaluate how the complexity of the file system development is reduced. Okay, so you give me some examples. Okay, here is what you will be doing if you did not have this reliable transactional block layer, and this is what it looks like if you do that. I mean, if you use this, so you need to sort of have some detailed evaluation, because that's the main purpose, right? That you want to simplify file system development. And the second important evaluation criteria is, well, how reliable is the system? So for instance, if you want to talk about fault tolerance, bring down a node and show what happens on a timeline, right? What if there is one entity here which is called the version coordinator, for instance. Bring down the version coordinator and say how the new version coordinator is elected. They talk about election, selection. It's all at a very high level. But if you were to evaluate these things, then I would be convinced that, yes, this is something which is working and everything is fine. But without those evaluations, just show me some performance numbers without any failures being simulated at all. It is very hard for me to believe you.
Yeah.
So that's why, there's some reasonable techniques here, but nothing that I said was, wow, this is amazing. The problem seems valid to me, but I'm not convinced that the solution is there yet. So yeah, so that's, my rating is to be reject.
I gave it a reject.
You gave it a reject. Okay.
You're a top guy.
I have a general question. Why people are now trying to export functionalities from file system to block layer? Because if you export all the functionalities from file system to block layer, then block layer itself will become more complex.
Yeah, but you have one central point of making complex. I mean, you don't have to, every time you implement a file system, re-implement all those things.
Mm-hmm. But maybe you have to implement block layer.
I mean, there are some advantages and disadvantages of everything. But
so, for instance, if you do that at the, if you do some functionality at the block layer, you lose, semantic information about the content itself. So, is it an inode? Is it a data block? You lose all that information. So optimizations at the block layer work well for some kinds of, some classes of optimizations, but not perhaps for all optimizations. And here, for instance, a transactional block layer makes sense. I mean, if I want to write a new journaling file system, then I know that mm-hmm. I can just start a transaction and stop, and not to have to worry about ensuring that consistency inside the file system. So that's a nice feature to have. Certainly, the block layer becomes more complex. But I think these are the things that justify the paper. In this case, I want to know, well, how simple did the file system development get once this new interface is available? Do you have any other comments other than what I said?
I think you mentioned a lot, right?
Okay. All right. So let's move on to the next paper then. This is a systematic approach to
the microrecurve paper.
Mm-hmm. Oh no, hold on, there's one more paper before that. COFS.
Okay.
Yeah, that's George's paper.
Okay, so the paper is called COFS, a tool for file system visualization. And the main idea here is that in typical data center environment, there are many machines with that have many different file systems, right?
So one second. So Louis, you're the scribe here.
Yeah.
So you're the secondary. Okay.
Okay. So Okay, so there are many many machines with many different thought systems, and well, that can become a problem for in terms of administration, right? You have to administer a different thought system, probably with different tools and all that. So the main idea this guy proposes is okay, having this upper level file system that manages all the file systems that are beneath. So what does this mean? Okay, so I'm gonna have this upper level file system that in some way, when I create a file, it's gonna choose to what file system place that file in. Right? So if you have, let's say, one EXE3 partition, one EXE2 partition, and some, I don't know, FAT partition, is gonna, once you create that file, it's gonna allocate it to the partition that best fits its needs. Right? Well,
so
to some partition, not the one that best fits its needs.
So is this a distributed environment or
no?
Is
this is single machine.
Single machine.
Yeah.
Okay. Single machine with virtualization, yeah. A different file system.
No. The idea is that they implemented in a single machine. You decide where to place. You have multiple file systems, and you decide where to place the files.
Because in the abstract they mentioned GPFS and PVFS too, which are all cluster file systems. So I'm wondering if
Hadoop distributed
file system, which I mean, if it's just a single machine, why should they even talk about these?
I mean, all the implementation they talked about was single machine.
But I understood that the storage system was distributed, but the application itself
is not.
It's not. But now that you say that, I mean, doesn't make sense if you.
And why would you talk about
API API IO, right?
And yeah.
Makes sense to run it in some kind of cluster.
I mean, when they start off talking about parallel files.
Yeah, and they have this picture here, the peer one.
Yeah.
You have multiple clients, right?
Yes.
So you have a network fabric, and then you have multiple storage nodes.
Yeah, but see, but this is what I mean. That everything is in the client.
That's right. But the thing is that you have multiple clients, right? And that, you know, cluster distributed.
But there is some sort of centralized CFS metadata which is managing the whole cluster, right? And is this metadata for the entire cluster?
That's for the whole cluster. Yeah, because that's the metadata node that stores all the metadata managed by CFS.
Actually, in Figure 2 is more
centralized.
I think it's more clear. This is what they do. They have this file system interface, and then they have these two different modules. One is a data module, and another is a metadata module.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
yeah.
They have this centralized metadata where they store all the metadata, and the other one that just does what the metadata driver does it.
Each of these nodes
mm-hmm.
is one of these. That's what I understood.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
This one of these.
So the CFS is some sort of distributed file system then? I mean, it seems like a distributed file system because there is one metadata driver
It's just on a small layer, a small file system over the real file system.
Right, but that's what a distributed file system is.
Yeah, I mean,
no, but it's even above the distributed file system.
Even above the distributed file system?
Right. So,
so
you have PVFS, for instance, GPFS, and Hadoop, and what it does is that it, for instance, you send
mm-hmm.
create a file,
mm-hmm.
right? And this COFS somehow
mm-hmm.
will choose one of the file systems to create this new file. Create the file and send the response back.
Okay.
So
yeah. I mean, there's no communication between them. Probably all the I mean, they have this central metadata service that manages all
the metadata,
all those allocations and all that part.
So the clients just see one big file system.
Correct. The clients just see one big file system.
And underlying, you could have multiple distributed file systems like PVFS2.
You could have anything underlying, yes.
And PVFS2 has its own file set of underlying. You could have EXT3, Riser, and they're all combined into one PVFS.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you create, let's say, in the root, you create a file or a directory, right? And inside that directory, you create 10,000 files, then CRFS could create a third of those files in one file system, in some folder of that file system, and then the other third in another completed file system, and so on. But at the end, it will export a whole file system as it was created first. And that's why you need this this metadata notes.
Why do you want to...
So which does the mapping?
What?
Why do you want to...
I think George was about to explain that.
Why do you want to distribute what?
Why do you want to distribute those 10,000 files across different files?
Oh, well, you can have many reasons for that. I mean, probably you want to place every file in the best optimal... The file system the best suits it. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, if you have small files, then this file system is better for small files. This other file system is better for big files. And that sort of thing. I think that's one of the motivational.
Who chooses that? The COFS will choose that?
Yes, the COFS will choose where to allocate that file.
The user won't prefer?
No. No, for the user, everything's transparent.
So for the user, the user sees some hierarchy, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, but this hierarchy is converted into another hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. For one file system and another for another, and so on.
Right, so you have many of these.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And each of this could be, let's say, PVFS.
Right.
And this could be GPFS.
Uh-huh.
And this could be, let's say, the CXT3 local file
system. So it's the exact copy of the version 1.
No, it's not an exact. I think all of these get merged.
Exactly. All of those get merged.
Some kind of union.
Okay.
Also, this could be in with a total different name.
Hierarchy.
With a total different hierarchy and so on.
Yeah, so
all subsets of the main.
And the joining point there is handled by this metadata node that says,
mm-hmm.
okay, I have this file. Well, I think this
information.
I have this file that is mapped to this file system in this directory.
Okay.
With this file.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, makes sense now. Let's
continue. So, well, yeah, that's a basic idea. So
the motivation to do this is that the client should be oblivious to the management of the data and
well,
not having to deal with choosing the right file system.
Exactly. Yeah. See, yeah, to ease file system administration, because what they argue is that the metadata driver can be as complicated as you want to. So you can choose there and put the intelligence there that you want and allow better allocation and all that sort of thing. So they point out. Yeah,
go ahead.
For instance, here they point out that one of the things that you can do is bypass limitations of current file system. So if let's say you want to create a really really big file, you can bypass it using this virtualization technique. What I said, that automatically mapping files to the most adequate file system. Replicating files in different file systems. They also mentioned write offloading and some other things.
Write offloading?
Yes.
Because
what they propose is like this framework, this architecture, really, that is just having what they propose here. It's the data driver and the metadata driver that controls everything.
So at a high level, this idea seems reasonable, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, what are the challenges and what are the key questions that need to be addressed in making this work?
Yeah.
I think one of the questions is, well, if the underlying file systems are completely configured by COFS, so for instance, I will instantiate several instances of, let's say, EXT3 on local machines, and then I will put a PVFS that combines all of them into one file system, and then maybe I have another set of riser file systems that are combined into GPFS and so on. So I guess the challenge is, how do you make those combinations? How do you choose and configure the system so that you have the right set of choices to now make a magic?
And that, that's something that they don't address.
I think that...
What do they talk about for 12 pages then?
Well, they just talk about this, and that's... this is until page 7.
Okay.
So they mention a case study, and then they want to perform it.
Yeah, the configuration of what CRFS will do, the decisions that we'll make, as I understand, was done manually. So
that's my point.
Here, for instance, that this means that the user now has to tune. Has to tune the system CRFS. In section 4.2, in the second paragraph, I think they mentioned that implements a very simple policy to reorganize the user's file hierarchy into something adequate to take advantage of the underlying file system. Something adequate. That's all they said.
Yeah, the thing is that, I mean, all the good things, that is what they talk about, the advantages, they don't implement any of them.
Yes.
They say that this is future work. So all section 3.3, they say, okay, this is future work. They just gave an implementation, I would say a dummy implementation for the data driver and the metadata driver, but and that's basically it. Let me see. Yeah.
So what is the case study about? I mean, what are they talking about in the case study? Is that something which is interesting or?
No. It's just, I mean, no, it's not very, nothing.
It seems like, part of the motivation, this is like a part of a motivation that it was after the explanation. I don't know. It's weird.
It's more motivation.
I mean, yeah.
So they said, apparently, these guys are from some cluster thing. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Right? So they said that different distributed file systems are tuned for different applications.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very tuned. So the problem is that you cannot be... I mean, when you run a different application in that cluster, the file system was tuned for some application else, then that application would run.
You're right. They say that in the beginning, distributed file system. Clusters were used for running specific applications. And over time, more fields came interested in processing and started using clusters. So things became more general purpose, but the underlying software was still designed for the specific purpose applications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So apparently in the cluster world, it's like, you tune a file system for some type of workload, and then you mount that file system in some specific folder. So the user or the programmer of some application has to be aware of all the different file systems that they have, so he can choose the one that fits better the application that he's using.
But you have. So you have multiple copies of the data, one in each file system?
No. You just use the file system that better fits the application.
Well, actually, you can do many things, but they don't do any.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess then the one question I have is what are they doing in the evaluation?
Yeah, that's okay. They just evaluate the time taken to do file metadata updates. For instance, file creation
for different
touch, and so basically of metadata operations.
For different configurations, I mean.
Yeah, different configuration. They compare against GPFS.
Against GPFS, but I thought what they're doing here is that showing how when you specify one configuration of the file system, as you change the workload, the performance changes.
Yeah, but that's my point. They don't evaluate any of that.
No, and the other thing is that one of the claims is that.
I mean, yeah, all the interesting stuff they mention it here, but then they don't do any of that.
So here, when they say, for instance, figure 5, 4 nodes, 8 nodes, 16 nodes, GPFS,
mm-hmm.
it seems like they're just comparing different configurations of the file system.
Yeah.
So basically, let's say figure 5. So they have different configurations of GPFS,
mm-hmm.
and you could use any of these. You could use GPFS across 4 nodes,
mm-hmm.
or 8 nodes, or 16 nodes. The question is, which one will you pick? And I guess there their point is that based on that choice, you get different performance for different workloads. Is that what?
No, that's true. But
yeah,
I mean, that's true, but that was not their conclusion.
Yeah, actually, that's not what they're evaluating. They're just comparing GPFS versus COFS.
Oh, so COFS is here.
Yeah, COFS and GPFS.
I see.
So they're just comparing those two to see.
So in each of these workloads, they tuned the COFS in some way. And both GPFS and COFS use the same hardware, is it?
Yeah, they use the same hardware.
And here they're saying that, well, if you use COFS, it's going to choose the best case of all of these automatically.
No.
So
it doesn't do any of that. It just does it somehow.
I think.
Because they don't.
What they are doing here is to somehow evaluate the performance of the metadata node.
The
metadata node compared to the GPFS metadata mechanism.
Oh.
That's all.
Yeah, that's all the evaluation actually. Because that first they start with.
And what is the reason for their better performance? And do they say why the performance is better?
I don't remember.
So here, for instance, figure 7, you have average time per operation. It's a GPFS is 60 milliseconds and COFS is 1 millisecond.
But this is for scalability, for multiple threads running at the same time.
So why is that better? So do they have a good inference from their graphs?
No.
Do they try to explain the graphs and why the graphs looks the way?
Well, one of the things that I could never understand why they did so many repeat experiments. For me, all the experiments they did were the same.
Were the same?
For instance, you see this experiment average time per create. This is average time per stat, then this is average time per create, average time you stat, then open, close, and then here is the same.
Create,
average
stat,
create, stat, and new time.
Is it the workload is different?
No, the workload is a little different, but but they're just, I mean, no, sorry. They only use one tool to generate the workload. It's called MetaRace.
Uh-huh.
That is some benchmarking tool that just does all this. Graph practically for them. So
I think what we need to do is in the review suggest some directions for improvement,
mm-hmm.
you know, some very concrete directions for how they need to send a revised version of this paper, how the revised version of the paper should look like.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, well,
I mean, not to lay out the paper for them, but you have to address these questions.
Yeah. Okay.
Very well.
Yeah.
So those are the kind of things we need to put in the review.
The thing is that for my, well, from my point of view, this work is too preliminary.
Yeah.
Like,
which is fine. I think.
No, it's fine, but I mean, they have some things that they can do, but they just don't do it.
Yeah. So I guess what you need to say in the review is, these are the things that you should be focusing on,
okay,
and list those. And I mean, if there are some questions that they, you know, for instance, if the evaluation, okay, what sort of evaluation should you do instead of what you do right now? Which parts of the design should you provide further elaboration on?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Where are the missing details? Those are the kind of things that we want to put in our reviews, so that the authors, when they when they look at the review, they have a very good idea of how the next the revision of the paper should look like.
Okay.
Otherwise, there is, you know, the reviews are not a much up, right? I mean, in the end, we want to help authors to write better papers. Yeah, we have to reject papers. Unfortunately, you know, we cannot accept all papers which are submitted. But when we do reject papers, at that time, we have to be even more careful about what we send back in our reviews.
Okay.
So for me, the paper was quite good, but I didn't like that they didn't mention how CRFS selects the file system to send the next request. They don't mention that.
Well, CRFS cannot select. I mean, it's when the file is created,
it has to select some file system.
So you're saying when the file gets created.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't see a clear. I don't see clearly how are these policies.
Yeah, there has to be some formal guidelines, right?
Exactly.
So, for instance, if a process creates a file, what should I extend the interface where the process will say, okay, this file is going to be approximately 1 megabyte long.
Mm-hmm.
Then, so that the CFS, do I need to extend the POSIX, for instance?
Exactly.
You know, create API to say, okay, here's what I think the file would look like. And then CFS can make the right decision.
Yeah, but
and there has to be clear guidelines in terms of, okay, if these are the parameters of the file, then my choice, my decision would be the following.
Yeah, but not only that, I think more importantly,
how do you set it up?
No, what would be the access patterns to that file? I mean, that would determine better than just by the size of the file. I think it's a
That may but be. Are they talking about the access patterns?
No.
So that's your contribution then. Their contribution has to be, you know, whatever they talk about has to be more clear, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if they say file size is the primary criteria for choosing a specific file system,
mm-hmm,
well, then show me exactly how to make that decision.
But I think the paper was very well written, but they,
yeah.
I mean, the work is, for me, too preliminary. They have to, I mean, and they don't discuss that just because they say, okay, we don't implement any of these things.
Uh-huh.
All the interesting stuff, they don't implement it. They just implement the basic architecture, but don't discuss any of
the basic architecture actually sounds reasonable to me.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense, but the problem is not solved.
Yeah. So actually, yeah. So my rating was a weak reject.
Mm-hmm.
Said it was a new contribution, and it was important. And yeah.
Okay. But I think the key thing is that we have to be detailed in our review.
Okay.
Saying, okay, these are the things that you need to work on. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, if you think there should be more in the review, please go ahead and. And add that. Okay, so let's move on to the next one. Next paper.
No, that's probably after you put the comments about the
review. So weak reject, does it seem reasonable or reject? I mean, why is it a weak reject? Because the high-level idea...
The idea is very good. The idea is good. I found the idea very good. So.
Okay, that's why it's a weak reject. All right. So... let's move on to the next paper, which is system state restoration.
So you're crying. You can't.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, this paper, the problem they try to address in this paper is that in case of failures in the storage system, usually the recovery time is much higher, and sometimes it also results in loss of service. So what they suggest is that usually what happens in the failures is that a small subset of threads fail, not all of them fail. So they suggest that you should be able to recover just the small subset of threads that have failed while the system continues to execute normally. But that doesn't result in loss of service, and you can improve on the recovery time.
So you're saying some small subset of which threads? The recovery threads?
No, like there are multiple threads that are running, and
yeah.
usually the failure happens because of some problems in one of the threads, or one or more of the threads.
Oh, this is not hardware failure?
No, it's not hardware failure. It's
storage controller micro recovery.
Right. It's not hardware.
What are
failure.
We
doing? It's
I'm sorry, I couldn't read this paper at all, so I am completely lost on this.
Right, so it is micro recovery, meaning recovery of the specific threads or specific components that have failed in the system.
And what would these components be?
Well, any specific, smaller components or, I don't know, they have.
Like an active component, like
yeah.
a thread or a processor?
Yeah. Ricardo, do you have a paper?
Oh, you can keep it.
Okay. No, you haven't read the paper, so.
Yeah, but that's okay. I'm here, so I can read it.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so they don't specify specific examples, but, for instance.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So this is the storage controller that's failing? A storage controller?
Okay, at the beginning they do mention about the firmware, failures in the firmware because of bugs and code.
Okay.
But they don't specify that this is particularly for failures in firmware. I think it's like any failure because they haven't specified that also. The first thing, this paper was quite difficult to read, and there were a lot of, I don't know if Ricardo, if you found the same thing, but there were a lot of unanswered questions which you had to assume, and then as you go forward they were answered, and then
I'm trying to understand the problem itself.
So the problem is that in a system, in a storage system, if you have failures even in like certain threads in software, you sometimes have to, for instance, restart the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of restarting the whole system, you just recover these small subset of threads that are saved in the background, while the rest of the system is unaffected.
So these are threads that are doing, let's say, RAID reconstruction?
Yes, could be.
So you have Mega Pro, which has multiple threads that does recovery. Is that the kind of setting?
This has nothing to do with RAID failure or anything.
Storage controller.
Yeah, so they don't talk about RAID. They just talk about failures of threads, software threads. It's nothing to do with the hardware failure. Failures or anything.
It's not about storage failure. It's about the threat.
It's about improving the system recovery time, or rather, letting the system run as it were without interruption, while improving the recovery of these small threats. It's not media failure. Exactly, the title is misleading.
No, the title says systematic approach to system state restoration during storage controller micro recovery. So something inside the storage controller needs to be recovered.
Right.
So that doesn't point to disk failure actually.
Yeah, so this has nothing to do with any media failures. Failures due to bugs and code.
Bugs and code inside the storage controller.
Yes.
Inside the firmware.
The storage controller is managing a whole bunch of storage.
Yes.
And while it's managing that storage, it has several threads that it does. I don't know what these threads do, but one of those or a few of those threads actually failed, and we want to restore the state of those threads
without affecting other threads. Yeah.
And one thread failing should not take down the entire controller.
Exactly.
Is that the idea?
Well, one thread, well, there are times when one thread failing does take down the entire the whole controller, and you do have to do a system level recovery, like restart. But there are times when that does not happen. So if you can avoid the system level recovery, then you could use the system. So it happens in the background. So that's the point.
So Ricardo, do you have anything to say about the problem? Anything?
Now it's a little bit clear. I didn't know what these threads were. But it seems like these are threads running in the controller itself. I was thinking on
exactly, that's what I said, because the title says it's a storage controller. Here they have a discussion of, you know, in the introduction they have a small paragraph about disk firmware, but in general in the paper they don't mention anything about storage controller or
storage.
Talk about failures and locks, but we don't know where these are happening.
And the threads are running. Where are the threads running?
But here they say modern storage controllers
are
highly concurrent embedded systems with millions of lines of code, and they refer to 14 and 25. That can probably give us more clues as to what. Okay, 14 is high-end file systems, and 25 is multi-core architectures. Oh, that's enhancing storage system availability on multi-core architecture.
So ANT file system is what is?
What?
Why is ANT file system?
There may be some discussion inside ANT file systems that talks about storage controller being highly complex and so on. But 25, which is enhancing storage system availability on multi-core architectures using recovery-conscious scheduling. Maybe we should look at that to understand what these guys are talking about, the context of this paper. So you had some problems understanding the context of the paper?
Yes. A lot of things were not clear. It's not very readable.
Can you understand those?
I have the three. I haven't really read it that much. I just read it with the intro and then everyone in English. I haven't read.
The what?
Okay, I haven't really read.
At least you're truthful. That's important.
but I think most of the at least the introduction and the second section, it was very hard to read. A lot of things that.
That's not good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. Should we continue? I mean, is there any?
And then they also talk about during the thread recovery, there are these dependencies which need to be resolved. So they also talk about how they keep track of dependencies and.
Did they provide examples of dependencies? What sort of dependencies are these?
Yes, they did provide some examples, which were not very clear.
Mm-hmm.
The first example was clear. Like, suppose you have a lock which is shared by two different threads.
Okay.
And if one thread is holding the lock and it fails, then the other thread would wait on the first thread, and you know those kind of dependencies. So I think they mentioned four specific updates here. One is dirty reads, which means data written by the failed thread has been consumed by another thread.
Uh-huh. But can that happen if there is, and don't the threads need to synchronize their read and write operations?
Synchronize the read and write operations.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, one thread writes something and the other thread reads it. I mean, there has to be some way of
synchronizing.
Yeah.
Assuming there are these independent two threads, that's what the example is. But there is no synchronization between threads. So one is the dirty reads, the other is lost updates.
The dirty reads again, what is it?
Dirty reads meaning, one thread has written some, one thread has written some value for some variable, which is read by another thread.
This is not
so
data.
There are two threads, right? One, that's a T1 and T2, they're two threads. And T1 writes overwrites a variable to some value and T1 fails.
In memory or on disk?
In memory.
In memory.
No, okay. I think it's in the firmware. I understand that everything here is happening in the firmware, right?
Yeah, yeah, memory of the firmware.
Oh, okay.
Controller memory.
Okay.
Yes.
So T1 writes some value which T2 reads and T1 fails. So that's the dirty read.
Oh, because that read is not going to be valid when T1 recovers?
Right,
no.
Because if you recover T1, then it probably is recovered back to the stage when it was in the normal working condition.
But there will be
so
a whole bunch of such reads, right? Bunch of dirty reads.
Right.
Yeah, but are they assuming some transaction mechanism or something like that?
Transaction mechanism.
Yeah, because I mean, to talk about dirty reads, I mean, you're assuming that you don't have. I mean, you're at some point, a lot of times, you're in a non-consistent state.
Right.
So let's say you have. I mean, here's my imagination about what's going on.
Yeah, you have to use a lot of it to read the paper.
Right, that's a different version of the paper.
Maybe it's a completely different concept. But let's say you have two threads, okay, and they're cooperating to do something. Great. And so one of the threads is doing part of the task, the other thread which reads variables that are set up by the first thread and does its own thing. At some point during the execution, the first thread fails. Now the first thread needs to recover to a point where none of this happened. All the variables that were changed by thread one did not actually change. So the actions that thread two took were probably incorrect, because if these operations are not idempotent, then then the next time thread 1 does the same thing, the effects will be something completely different.
Right. So the example they use is about a single variable. Thread 1 is incrementing the variable, thread 2 is decrementing the variable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's their example. Then the other is lost updates, where...
Okay, so how do they solve the problem of dirty reads?
Well, they don't solve... they have different... they have these four states which they take into account, and based on that they create dependencies, which I didn't understand two of them, but anyway. The dependencies are modeled using states. So they use a state system for modeling here. So if T1 has written something, for instance, and T2 reads it, and this happens before the failure of T1.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is some recovery criteria associated with this dirty read scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And this recovery criteria has to be satisfied for the recovery to happen for that thread.
So the thread has to be restored to the state that there are no dirty reads at all?
Right.
How does that happen?
What?
No, that I think I heard about something like that. That looks like an distributed systems problem, right? It creates weight and
those are systems problems.
I mean,
those are just when you're working on multi-thread.
So what would you say is the contribution of this paper?
It wasn't really very exciting, maybe because the motivation was a little weaker. You know, they had like an analysis of the failures in the controller, for instance, how many failures are there at this level, and out of that, how many do not require a system level restoration, and you know, that kind. That would have been fine.
No, but I mean, it seems like a valuable problem to work on.
Yes.
I mean, if you
have the problem is yes.
if you have storage controllers that have multiple threads which are, I don't know, doing what in parallel.
Well,
we need
I think
to
it's
find
not.
That out.
Yeah, and the thing is, this may not only be limited to storage controllers. It could also be like
any system.
Any system, exactly. It doesn't have to be at the storage controller level.
So you're saying this not necessarily for fast. Is that what you're saying? I mean, how is it related to storage? I mean, do they talk about I/O operations or not really?
No, they don't talk about I/O operations. That was one thing that I thought that it's probably not related to storage. Maybe in some architecture conference, possibly instead of storage, but maybe because it's the storage controller that here which we think they are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So they use the system like a state space method, and they have different states for each of the threads. They keep track of the different states for each of the threads, and they also keep track of the dependencies between the threads. So if a thread fails, then it is restored back to its non-original state based on the recovery criteria, and the recovery criteria takes into account all the dependencies, and that's how the.
So is there a reason why they say storage controller in the title? They do say storage.
They could be confused for
They say storage controller
there must
in
be
the title.
Why
there is this only single paragraph which talks about failures in this, and then the experimental evaluation talks about logs, which I didn't understand what they were really talking about.
Logs.
It's
a storage
console. Yeah. So if you see table 2,
in the
and they talk about locks in fiber channel I which
locks per IO. Locks per IO operation. So the number of locks that are involved for each IO operation.
Yeah, that's locks per IO.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a fiber channel lock, is that one thing? And an IO state lock, a resource lock, a resource state lock, and a throttle timer lock. The first
one. Those are the various entities that need synchronization, the fiber channel, these are the various, I would say, data structures in the microcontroller that need locking.
And then they say out of these, they pick 4 for the evaluation, but they don't mention which 4.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess so that's maybe poor
and
writing.
And then the contention cycle, meaning for how long the log was tracked and what were the number of accesses within those CPU cycles. So
I guess what you're saying is that the paper itself is not very clear what they are talking
about.
It's
not very clear, but I mean, if they improve on the writing, I think the evaluation is reasonably okay.
What would you suggest in the comments?
Well, the motivation has, the paper definitely has to be rewritten, you know, with a lot more clarity. The motivation, I'm not sure whether it's for storage controller or for a general system failure or
what. They have all of these locks for IO, I mean, all of these are storage related.
Right, but IO. Why can't this be used at a, you know, any of the, at the system level? Why at the storage controller level? Why can't it, I mean, stuff.
I don't know.
It looks like the random paper.
Looks like the
random paper generator.
Random paper generator. Do you think that is true?
No. I hope not.
So, I mean, what would be your sort of concrete suggestions for improvement? I mean, what do they need to fix? I mean, I think
the idea behind the paper is quite good. And the problem is also reasonably good, assuming it's for system level. I'm not sure about what you know, how many or rather how this is. Why is this limited only to storage controller? That's my main problem.
Well, assuming that somehow it is limited to storage controller, what do you think would be sort of the key contributions of the paper? Let's give them the benefit of doubt that yes, it's, you know, it's most relevant to storage controllers. And if that were true, then what would you say are the key contributions? Is there one big contribution or is there several small contributions?
Well, then assuming, even if it is for a storage controller, they say that this can be applied to you know, scenarios when there is a thread failure which does not require system level restoration. But how often does that happen? Or, you know, like if the storage controller failures occur like say X times a month, out of that how many do not require system level restoration? You know, some analysis of that kind would probably make the motivation stronger.
Okay. So you're saying the motivation can be improved. So, but what are the contributions of the paper?
The contribution is that present this...
what are the ideas in the paper that help solve this problem? What are the new ideas in the paper?
Well, they use a safe space method to... model the thread state. Then they also keep track of thread dependencies. So
you would you say that the modeling of the recovery problem is one of the contributions, that they model the dependencies between the threads?
Yes.
With all these, the conflicts, you know, the dirty reads, lost updates, unrepeatable reads, resource ownership?
Yeah, right.
You say these are sort of modeling what are the... what are the challenges that need to be addressed in recovering threats?
Challenges or...
Dependencies,
actually.
Yeah, Ariel is busy with some. He already sent me.
Dependencies, actually. And again,
So those are the... That's modeling the
They have
the
just
problem.
Modeled the problem, actually. But they don't actually specify, you know, like...
The solution?
Not the solution, but you know, maybe it could be improved with some. They provide some more implementation details, like how they keep track of these states or dependencies or what structures they use. And
trying to look at the sort of the meat of the paper, which seems to be in section 2 and 3. In section 3, they talk about modeling thread dependencies.
Yeah, in section 3 is about how it works,
and
section 2 is like the architecture and the introduction. What they're doing.
So how it works, so 3.1 says, I'm just reading section titles right
mm-hmm.
now. 3.1 is modeling thread dependencies.
Okay.
3.2 is restoration protocols.
Mm-hmm.
So they talk about how to restore
mm-hmm.
once the thread fails.
Right.
And then section 4 is log lock execution model.
Yeah, I also didn't get by the name that's log lock.
Maybe for anonymity.
But it's a weird name for anonymity.
Or probably the random generator.
Okay, 4.1 is tracking state changes.
Mm-hmm.
What is tracking state changes? So each time there is a state change, you track that.
Mm-hmm.
4.2 is recovery using restoration protocols.
Right, so you have the different states now and you have the restoration protocol, so how do we work?
And then 4.3 is implementation details.
Yeah,
so to me it seems that they are talking about how to model the problem of tracking thread dependencies and then restoring the state of the system so that you do not need a complete reboot of the system.
Right.
So you have a partial restoration. And the reason you can do partial restoration is because you track all these dependencies explicitly, so you know exactly how to restore the state of the system without having to roll it back to state zero.
Right.
Okay. So yeah, that seems reasonable to me. Okay. So, what is your rating on this paper?
Weak accept.
Weak accept. All right, so it seems like we need to have a more detailed review of this paper, right? Just to understand what really is going on inside. I certainly need to read the paper. Okay, let's move on to the next paper then, which is Click.
Okay.
Click paper.
I'll use the board to explain it clear. So the paper proposed a second layer cache management technique
based on hints. The idea is that...
Based on what?
Hints.
Oh, hints.
The idea, other thing, the idea is that you have a first level cache, and you have a bigger second level cache. And for example, from the point of view of the second
column... Those are the same type of cache.
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
The idea is that you know from here that you have a cache up there. So, for example, at this level of the system, if we, for example, this is for IO buffer cache.
Mm-hmm.
For example, at this level, if we receive a write that was based on a eviction at this level, let's say a page out, you can assume that you don't have to cache it again because it's... I mean, you will assume that you will have to cache it again because more likely you will be using it again. But let's assume this was a write because of a sync call on this web. This means that most likely this page will also be here, so you don't really need to cache it. The idea is that there is some information lost from here to here that help you decide whether or not to keep the page, and that information is called a hint. The idea is to tag every IO request with a hint that helps the second level cache knowing whether or not to cache the page. So the thing is that on previous work, this hint idea was pretty much hard-coded into the system. For example, on the system you have to specify at this level, these are the hints, and this level, these are the hints you're going to receive. And for each type of hint, you need to specify what are the
responses.
For example, if you receive a hint for a write based on an eviction, you need to keep it or not keep it. You have a specific response. The issue with that is that while you're making it hard-coded, you might be losing some extra information, some extra hints. So the idea would be to have as many hints as possible, and here at this level, use as much information from this other layer as possible. And also because it's never good to hard code something. I mean, this can change, and it means that you have to change also this. So what they proposed is...
So for instance, the kind of hint could be, so this is a write from the page cache, this is a write from virtual memory versus a write from the file system page cache.
Exactly.
So you could have that sort of thing without just saying, okay, here's the write.
Exactly. Or for example, hints based on priority. You can specify some pages that have highest priority to be on the cache. Let's say they're related to a more critical application. So there is a lot of information that you will have to pass to the second layer cache and you pass it to hints. So what they propose in this paper, this idea of hints is not new, but what they propose is to have a more dynamic view of this. The thing is that now page replacement is based on the frequency and on the reuse distance of hints. So the idea is that now you don't have to know that for this type of hint you need to cache or not cache. The idea is that you will learn on time that for these type of hints are highly frequent or have big reuse distance or small reuse distance. And based on that information, based on those statistics, you'll know whether to cache this type of hint or not.
What is the information again?
The statistic they were saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically two. One is the frequency is just a counter of how many hits for this type of hint do you have.
Okay.
And the other is the reuse distance. The reuse distance is, for example, if you have a stream
like a time series,
and you receive the hit number one here and the hit number one hit again, this is the reuse distance, three.
Okay.
So this gives you an idea of how frequent, how close they are.
Okay.
The request of type one.
Okay.
So the idea is that each hint has a priority associated with it, and the priority is equal to n, the frequency, how frequent is this hint, over the reuse distance. the idea is that reuse distance is kind of is the cost of keeping this. You know, if this reuse distance is very large, I mean, you're keeping something that's not that useful. So, and the idea is now that based on this, every hint has this priority. And the idea now is that you use this priority for page refreshment. Let's say, for example, you have your cache, the second level cache is completely full. So the page that you're going to evict is the one that has the hint with the lowest priority.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
The eviction.
So this is pretty much what they do. This is the main idea. But this has a very big issue. The thing is that first there are two things. First thing is that
wait a second. So you said that you will evict one block, let's say, or one, I don't know,
page
that is in the cache that has the lower priority.
That is related to the hint that has the lower priority.
So you have several blocks with the same priority. Which one do you?
That's a question we have for you. I think you have just that question. It can be random.
Then they start it with the sequence number.
So that what again is N and R?
N is a counter that says it is
really
how many hits are to this hint.
Okay, and R?
And R is
the distance. Okay, so they need to constantly update all that information.
Exactly, they have to maintain those studies.
Okay.
And that's an issue because you have many types of hints.
Yeah, because you have to update it for each element in the cache.
Okay. Exactly, so they have some...
And each element that is not in the cache. Also.
Exactly, so they have some... That's the thing. So now they have to maintain these for all the elements in the cache, and they have a...
And the ones that are not in the cache.
Ones out in the cache. They have a limited queue that they call out queue. And they do it for these. So you see that if you keep it, if you reduce, you're losing some information that you don't have. But they show on the experiments that actually this is not really affecting performance.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a limited out queue and you still perform well. But now the big issue with this is that this replayment strategy, you see that for example, to sort hints based on frequency and reuse distance, there are already many algorithms, for example, ARC, even LRU, but LRU will not be based on reuse distance. The thing is that instead of using those, they propose their own.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But this strategy is not solving some issues that, for example, ARC is solving. For example, this will get caches completely polluted for sequential access, for example. For example, if you have this cache completely full, and you have a large sequential access of this size, you have each request with the same hint, so you will pollute this cache. You will completely remove what was before, which is solved by ARC.
No, but if you're constantly updated, then you will not have that problem.
But not ARC, because these have the same hint.
But isn't ARC a replacement policy?
Yeah, but ARC will help you know will help you to know which are the hints that are highly reused or not reused and based on reuse distance as well. And it cannot be affected by this type of access. For example, sequence access.
Yeah, I understand why ARC will work for the sequential patterns. My question is, can I use this in combination with ARC?
That's what I'm saying, this guy.
I cannot do that.
You could.
You could.
I mean,
so how do you modify the priority then?
Then I won't use this priority. I won't use this.
So then you're saying don't use this at all.
And no. You will be using hints, but not sorting hints based on this. Sorting hints based on ARC, for example. This is used to know which hints are the less valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only the.
But I see it orthogonal. I mean, you could use either one.
Here, you are not solving these issues, for example. Or some
but I don't. I agree with George, but what is the problem in sequential access? He's going to remember after a certain amount of.
Yeah, because he keeps updating that.
Exactly.
No, I mean, if you have this access after this, you will pollute the cache. You will remove all that was here.
But why?
Because after some accesses will have high priority because this is the same thing.
And why is it
so after a while, this will have priority over these guys.
So the hint is based on the frequency, right?
Based on the frequency and the reuse distance. And for a sequential access, reuse distance is almost zero and frequency will get very high. Mm. But this is solved by ARC.
So what are the advantages of this over ARC?
I don't know. And they compare it against LRU.
And not ARC.
ARC is a single level replacement. It doesn't talk to other levels, right? I mean, it's a...
Yeah. No. Okay, but here I'm talking about ARC at a different level. ARC to sort hints.
ARC to sort hints.
But you could use ARC not and not considering hints. ARC directly to the second level cache.
Okay.
But even that would be okay. Because the problem with second level cache is that you lose temporal locality. And they show that's bad for some algorithms like MapReduce. But they don't show it for...
No, they are compared with one another algorithm that use the hint.
Exactly, that you saw, but for non-intrusive algorithms like ARC or CAR or 2Q, you will perform okay, but you don't know how this will perform compared to those because the experimentation doesn't show.
So do they do promotions or demotions?
No, it's not that type of caching. It's just hints.
So hints, I mean, one basic problem I have is that all the blocks in the same hint class are treated exactly at the same level.
Exactly. Yeah.
But that may not necessarily be true. I mean, I could have more popular blocks at the same hint level as less popular blocks.
Yeah, right? that's why in that case you need to define more hints.
So then you need to you might have a block which is popular now but no longer popular later on. So you have to change hints also. The hint you have to reconfigure hint classes dynamically.
Why not just
make each block a hint? I mean, at the extreme case, each block becomes a hint, and then you automatically.
So
what happens in that?
And you end up with LRU.
Yeah, for example, you have many eviction rights. So these have a specific hint. Right.
The reason they are all combined into a single hint is because they have some commonality.
Exactly.
What is that commonality?
The commonality for this hint is that you don't have to cache it. I mean, in this case, you have to cache it. You learn that for this type of accesses, it's better to cache. So if you get a new one with the same hint, you know that it's better to cache it.
No, but the problem
you learn.
Yeah, you learn something about this class of requests, which is classified as a hint to begin
exactly,
with.
Exactly.
So, which means that if there is no common characteristic in these blocks which have assigned the same hint, you really cannot learn anything.
Exactly. So that's another concern. The choice of hints is critical. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, if the blocks that you put in the same hint do not behave the same way, then you cannot learn anything.
Exactly. So the choice of hint is critical in that way, and also if you have hints that span the whole type of access, or hints that are very specific.
Right.
So the choice of hint is critical here. So that's some other concern that is not addressed at all in the field. But still, this gives the infrastructure to do some smart thing.
Yeah, I mean, I see what the idea is. It seems interesting, but I'm struggling to figure out how to use the idea. I don't yet get how to really use the idea.
A simple example is the write, different types of write. Another example is priority. So, I mean, importance of requests. For example, if you access if you specify a range on the disk to be really important, you can do this. You can specify these types of things with this being infrastructure.
Yeah. So there are two pieces of work: demote and promote. You know that, right?
Yeah, but that's a different type of cache.
It's a different type of cache.
Yeah. it's another type of intrusive caching, and hint is another type. Here you're trying to affect the behavior of the second level cache based on hints alone. You're not actually saying evict this at this level of.
Yeah, but then how do you cache something in the first level?
No, in the first level you don't care. This is independent.
The application is managed in the first level.
The application won't be changed.
And then how does something that is in the second level go to the first level?
I mean,
if you have a hint that is very good and you're getting all accesses to there, then why don't you transfer it to the first level?
At the end, it will be transferred to the first level because...
But when is at the end? I mean,
for example, you have a read. And the page is not here. So you read it from here and you place it here. This gives you another
hint. Right.
This gives you another hint. You see that, for example, for this type of access, if you just remove it from if you just read it from here to give it to this guy, it might be likely that you don't have to cache it anymore.
Yeah, and if it's a write?
And if it's a write, it can have different hints.
So writes come with hints, reads do not come with hints.
Reads can also come with hints.
Any IO can come with hints. Any IO can come with hints. So the question is, if I read something just now and it has a high hint, should I still be caching it in this second level? I mean, so I'm trying to figure out how to make these caches exclusive, right?
That's the first question. Are they exclusive?
It doesn't have to be exclusive. Based on hints, a goal of the hints would be to make caches exclusive.
So, but how does this happen in this case?
No, the caches are not exclusive.
They don't have to be exclusive.
They don't have to be, but you want them to be exclusive,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, but not only, you don't only want it to be exclusive because you don't want this to be, for example, if you have this completely exclusive, but at the cost of having garbage here, things that you will never do.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I mean, you want the cache to be used properly, but it is better, if everything else is constant, it is better to have two caches exclusive than two caches which have overlap.
Exactly. So one technique is to actually manage the cache from here to here direct, the most and from most. But that's a different type of cache. In this type of cache, you try to improve exclusivity based on hints.
Right, but how do you maintain exclusivity with hints? Like, if a block has a very high hint, likely it's going to be in the first level cache. How do you ensure that it's not duplicated?
Yeah, because you get that
hint, you're
not sure.
Yeah,
but then if both the blocks are in the first level cache, it's not going to come to the second level cache. So the second level cache won't even cache the data.
Okay, let's slow down a little bit.
Only the blocks that are going to be evicted from the first level cache and come up with a specific hint that are going to be accessed by second level cache.
Okay, that's okay. I mean, that's for demotion, but how about promotion?
Yeah.
Well, when an application doesn't find anything in the first level cache, then it calls the second level caching, right?
Yeah, but, okay, yes.
And then if second level cache has the specific space, it just passes it.
Yeah, but won't you pass all the one that has the same hint? I mean,
you pass a specific page requested.
Yeah, but then you say you handle everything by the same hint, so you would have to transfer all the ones that have the same hint.
No. Only to watch
only it's a page level hint.
No, it's not page.
No, that's
I mean, many pages have the same hint.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that when you're treating for example, when this is full and you're evicting the one that has the lowest priority hint, it doesn't mean that you will have to evict all those that have the same hint. You only need one page. You don't need to remove everything.
I'm trying to see if this can... It seems like you can have exclusive cache here. Because if the a page is requested into the upper level cache, then you can remove it from the lower cache.
Yeah.
But when do you include it back into the lower cache? If that page is not modified and just gets thrown away from the upper level cache, it won't be seen by the lower level cache. So there is no demote operation for the lower level cache to see it. So which means that the lower level cache is a superset of the first level cache.
Yeah, but not necessarily, because you can have For this type of read request, you can read
a request which is a very small priority, and then it will not be in the lower level.
I think that it's better not to see this with the exclusivity of caching as a goal. It's better to see this with increasing hit ratio as a goal.
Yeah.
Exclusivity is just it will appear by magic when you increase hit ratio.
Yeah. I mean, I have a question about exclusivity. So you're saying that that's not the primary.
That's not the primary
concern.
The primary concern is increasing the hit ratio of this. But while you increase the hit ratio of this, you will see some exclusivity.
So let's say that that's the case. Let's say that's the main concern. Then the question I still have is, why not associated one hint with each page? And then, you know, what happens in that extreme case?
Yeah, but if you have that extreme case, for example, you learn this for this type of hint, and you have another request for the same type of hint that you have never seen before.
So you're saying
you don't have that the information to handle this smartly.
You're saying that because the application knows that all these data items are somehow related, it can categorize all of them into the same hint.
Yeah, exactly.
So the application needs to inform the first level cache that, well, these items are all belonging to the same.
Yeah, that's it.
So there is some interaction with the application as well.
Yeah, the application has to supply the hint.
So that's changing.
Yeah, that's
memory management.
You have to, for example, on the experiment they use DB2, and DB2 was changed to request IOs with hint.
Okay, so that's another big difference than, let's say, multi-level exclusive caching, where the applications do not need to get involved.
In this case, they need to be changed. But still, that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I'm not against that. The question I have is, how does this compare against promote and demote type caching mechanisms? I mean, why don't they compare with the latest that's out there, which is, say, demote, or no, which was the latest one? Promote.
Yeah, last year they had promote.
I prefer to see it like this. There are different families of caching strategies.
Okay.
And in this family of caching strategies, hint-based, they convert these to hint-based strategies.
Okay. And let's say in this, so what your argument is that in this class of strategies, the goal is to improve the hit ratio.
Exactly. That's the main goal of a cache.
Of the lower level.
Yeah.
And what is the goal of the other class of strategies, which is exclusive caching, is to make these exclusive? It's also to improve
hit ratio, but they have different requirements. In this case, these are intrusive caching, but this requires a different type of change than the mode and promote.
Yeah. So I mean, it seems to me that here you need to change the interface between the caches, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to supply additional information. The same thing with promote and demote class of algorithm. The goals are the same, which is
it's a different family,
which is fine. But I mean, you are arguing for a specific family or specific class of approach to be used. But you need to compare against the other class of approach, right?
Yeah, because at the end you're solving the same problem. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's true.
And I mean, if you see that, well, promote actually does better than this, then you don't even need to be inclusive. Because promote is not inclusive. It's maybe more well accepted. And if the performance is more or less the same, then you'd rather use promote than use hint. I know why you like the paper, because it has a new idea. I see that. But I think this is great. I mean, I certainly like the idea as well, but I think you have to do that comparison.
Yeah.
For fast paper, you have to do this sort of comparison.
Yeah, that's true.
Because last year you had a paper which was talking about promote, and before that you had demote and all that. so many classes of algorithms for multi-level class. You have to compare this.
Right. And they are using the same approach. Saying they are related word dimension. These are different types of families for caching and like related words. Some people do that.
PQ, for instance, it's not inclusive.
Yeah, or so even ARC.
TQ is not inclusive. Why compare against TQ? Why not compare against the more recent caching approach?
They compare against LRU.
LRU.
But LRU is also not from the same family.
Yeah, but LRU is not, it's not from any family. LRU is the crappiest replacement algorithm you can imagine in the universe. So it's really...
No, it's from the same family as Promote and Demore.
No, Promote and Demore are intrusive.
So my
LRU is not.
Well, I don't know.
So here are some of my comments. Okay, I read this paper. No, I couldn't read the whole paper, but I read some part of it. The first thing which I thought was that there is no reason for using the space-saving algorithm. So there is some space-saving algorithm that they talk about, which is. Is that also your comment? Because they said that, well, we can reduce the number of hints by doing space-saving. Well, you might want to do that if each hint is a page, but if each hint is a large collection of pages, then you don't need to reduce the number of hints from 4,000 to 1,000. I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, the problem is that you are at this level. You don't know if the application is generating billions of hints.
Right, but
it's just to be safe.
Mm-hmm. Right, but in their they actually implement the space saving, which automatically remove some hints, right?
Yeah, but that's great, because if you didn't do that and the application generates thousands and thousands of hints...
Well, the question is, how many hints do you expect to manage? I mean, so you're saying that application could have large...
The idea is it's not that much on number of hints. The idea is you need to gather some useful information from the hint.
So I see. So you're saying that the hints could be really large. Because I looked at some 1,000 hints or something like that. And there would be no reason to do any space saving with 1,000 hints. But if there were a million or a billion hints, then yes.
And that gives you the opportunity, for example, if you're not really concerned of picking hints smartly, you can randomly pick any type of hint, and this will extract the valuable information from them.
But that's dangerous, because you might pick wrong hints and then you cannot learn anything.
Exactly.
So that was my second comment, which is the feasibility of hint specification.
Yeah.
How do you know that you're picking the right hint?
You never know.
The quality of hint has to be somehow determined.
Yeah.
I mean, how can we... So this paper, for instance, talking about hints as a fundamental primitive for determining the importance of pages in the second level cache.
Yeah.
How do I know that my hints are good quality hints?
You never know.
No, you have to depend on
that. You never know, but there should be a way to know. I mean, based on, let's say, how your algorithm is performing, right? I mean, if you know that your algorithm is completely lousy, hit ratio is 0%, then I know that my hints are messed up. Right.
Yeah, a way could be, for example, you have a hit ratio after a period of time, and you can calculate the optimal replacement for what you saw, and you have this and these numbers.
It's the same problem you were pointing out here. That's the question right now.
Why?
Because this is just an example of what Roger was saying.
No, but in this case, whatever hint you pick, this will get lousy.
So if you have one hint per page, then it's fine.
Yeah, but you will gain anything.
So my point is that you need to somehow in the paper address quality of hinting. How do I measure, how do I know that my hints are good? And how, if they are not good, can the system respond to that and adapt based on that?
Yeah, but
I like the idea at a high level that you want to use hints, which is nice. But I think for this to be complete, you have to address some questions. I mean, one of the questions, how do you specify hints of good quality? How do I recognize hints of good quality?
Yeah, but it's better to see this as an incremental improvement on the idea of hints. This paper doesn't have to solve all the problems with the hint-based approach.
It doesn't have to solve it, but I would say that at least you have to talk about the quality of hints somewhere. I mean, let's say, okay, this is the quality of hints is the problem. I mean, do they say anywhere that, I mean...
No.
So I need to understand the author understand that quality of hints is a problem.
But
and I think that a good paper would actually address that as well.
Yeah.
So okay, so that's my second comment. Third comment is what I already said, which is promote, demote are less inclusive algorithms. You should be comparing against those to convince a reader that, well, this is actually worth doing. I mean, it is worth having hints and being inclusive because there is real gain to be had beyond simple exclusive caching algorithms.
But you see that the modern promote is way more intrusive, right? For example, for a new application here, to use this infrastructure, it's pretty simple. You only have to define hints.
Right, but the new application does not need to define anything if you have promote demote.
Yeah, but if you have demote promote, the cache of this application will have to be changed. What manages the cache?
You know? Yeah,
well, you will only. Oh, you mean application level?
Yeah, I mean because the first level cache don't have to be the cache of a VM. It can be the cache of a database,
the application
of a data of an application.
Sure.
Any type of first level cache.
Sure, sure. But in the same way, I mean, you could have demote capability included into the cache. I mean, if you want to add hinting, you're also adding that. So you're saying in some way it's inclusive. So demote and promote also become inclusive.
No, much more intrusive.
More inclusive. No.
Yeah.
Why would you?
Because you have to add an interface to your cache management for these guys to touch it.
That's with promote.
Yeah.
So with demote, you don't.
And demote is the same. Demote is pretty much the same because now your cache has to interact with this. That's actually adding code to every application.
Yeah.
It is much more difficult than just specifying hints.
Yeah. I see that promote can be more intrusive than hinting in especially if you want to have cache managed by the application.
Yeah.
But that's not the normal case. Unless you have some database.
Yeah, but you have caches at every level. Even when you use buffered reason, right? You have caches.
Yeah, but
the other main target is you have caches everywhere.
No, but if you have web server, for
example.
If you have web server, then web server doesn't have really any application level caches.
Exactly.
Just throws it away. It just sends it over the next network.
Especially the target is the database.
Exactly. Database is the only thing, the only application I see.
Or
the
VM, virtual machine.
Virtual machine?
Yeah.
Why?
Because you have double cache. You have the base cache of the VM and you have the base cache.
No, not necessarily. If you
no, but each is an application. I mean,
it has some cache.
Okay, so. Yeah. So, I think that's all I had. I couldn't read the whole paper, so I couldn't read, for instance, the evaluation. So your recommendation is accept.
Yeah.
Okay. Your recommendation is accept. Okay. And you guys read the paper.
Yeah. But there are some concerns. I mean, this is pretty serious, and this. Even in the experimentation, they use databases and online transaction processing, and that's known to be random and small,
mm-hmm.
so they don't address sequential patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my big issue.
And how good is the evaluation?
Much better than LRU, but that doesn't say.
I mean, so you could add exceptions for something like that.
That's a simple thing.
I think the bigger problem is how do you specify the hints in the first place? I think that's the kind of question that they need to address, because hint quality is fundamental to the success
mm-hmm.
of this approach.
Yeah, but
I mean, if you have combined a set of blocks which have all different characteristics into one hint, you cannot deduce anything based on the group information.
Yeah, but what you're saying
is that a hint can change. A page has a specific hint, right? That hint may change over time.
So how do you change that is my question.
That is explained. It's hard for me to explain, but that's...
It is explained, I guess, right?
No, what you're saying is that
are requested.
For example, the application is requesting some page. For at time X, it requests a page with int X. At time Y, it requests a page with some another int. So, and the priority of the page to remain in the cache is determined by that int set. So as you change the hint, the priority is also changed.
Yeah, I understand. But how do you change the hint?
No, that's I don't know where would you do that.
I didn't get it. I didn't get where the hint is changed.
No, the hint for a request will not change.
It's just for a page.
For a page. Yeah, I mean for a page.
No, it could
be. No. Okay, for a page, yeah. I mean for a specific position on this, you will have reads or writes. So these have a hint and these have another hint.
Exactly. But hint, I thought, was based on, for instance, the data itself. So the data has a specific hint.
No, it's more like hints are not related to positions or reads or writes. Hints are related to anything, any application
level
information.
If that is the case, then you have to tell me how they are related.
They're related because whenever you send a request, you associate a hint with it. So, for example, in the application, if you are in the application at this level of code, any request you send from here will have the same hint.
Yeah, that's fine. But what hint will it have? I mean, what is the hint? If I do not, so if one simple thing is if everything in, let's say, slash form has a specific hint, everything in slash temp has a specific hint. And I could do this for VFS cache.
Okay. That's a bad election of hints.
But at least I know what my hints are.
Yeah.
But in this case, you're saying that my hints can be anything, but
yeah,
I mean,
it can be this or can be pretty much anything.
Yeah, but
yeah, but how do you decide which ones are good and which ones are not good? I mean, because if you have a bad selection of hints, you could perform even worse than LRU. I could guess.
That's what I'm saying. That's not a concern of this paper. That's a concern with the whole hint approach, which is not addressed by this paper.
But at least I think.
But the approach of the paper is a hint approach. That's the key contribution.
But doesn't
paper.
Have to.
No.
The hint. I mean, it's like.
It's
just an incremental improvement to the hint approach idea.
But how do you select? for this page, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The paper is not concerned with that. This is just an incremental improvement to the hint idea.
They just define the architecture for hints. That's what the paper does.
Architecture and
how hints are used.
How would you use the hint idea in a more dynamic way? We don't have it to hard code hints.
I see that. But there, I mean, as a reader, I have all these questions. What do I do? I mean, I go and call you up. You have to tell me in the paper itself.
I mean, I really believe this is enough for this paper. It's like
the level of contribution.
It feels like whenever you're writing a. This is an extreme example. It feels like whenever you're writing a paper about storage, you have to actually push for storage instead of writing things in paper. It's at the same level.
What? You have to what?
You have to implement it.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Okay, if you are working in the hint family of optimization, you say, I'm here. So you don't have to actually push for the whole thing. My analogy was, with computers in general. Whenever you're adding an optimization to computers in general, you don't have to push for the use of computers.
I see what you mean, but here, this paper is, I think, can be very, very strong. Okay?
Yeah.
Because it's talking about a new, completely new approach to exclusive, I mean, it doesn't have to be exclusive, completely approach, new approach to multi-level caching.
No, the hint idea is not. It's not new. There are many
oh,
references
there are?
To hints.
That's they compare with another hint-based technique also.
There are many hints. So this is what I'm saying. This is just an incremental thing to the hint idea.
In the other papers, they talk about
how to
select.
No. In the other papers, they use it's more hard coded. It's
the
more for this type of application. You can have this type of hints.
And
so,
that type of hint.
If you select the wrong hint for the block, that you're saying that there is no work that says how to do that. right? If you select the wrong int for the wrong block, then this, I mean, it will not won't behave very well.
No, no, it was complete. On the other papers, the set of hints are actually defined.
Mm-hmm.
For example, on the Durkater, some paper like that, they mention a set of three hints for writing.
Okay.
So the hint set is defined.
But
the response to the hint is also
fine,
defined.
They say how to assign those hints to certain.
Yeah, that's also clear because this hint is for eviction rights. This hint is for.
Okay.
For
this is more general. Rights. This is more general.
And this
no,
is
this more specific. I think.
This is completely specific. This
no, sorry. I mean, this would this work.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So what you're saying is that you could combine that work with this and have a good result.
For example, if the hint you implement here are these, you'll have the exact same result.
Mm-hmm. You will have exact same result.
Yeah.
Right. So that means that then you have to provide how to select the hints for each plot for this to work better than the others. Right?
The problem is that you cannot say that because that depends on the application.
But they have to specify or at least say some policies. For each, I mean,
the problem is if you do that,
the client will come up with its own hint types and with its own hint priorities.
Yeah.
Whatever you feel,
client
has
the infrastructure to do it.
Okay,
client will inform secondary structure that, yeah, those are the pages and those are the hints I prioritize most. And you.
So this is generalizing hint based approaches.
That's what I understand. Yeah.
Then I'm not. Even I mean now I'm even less convinced about the originality of this contribution because I mean then it's just this formulation of priorities, the number of hints divided by reuse, that's it.
Yeah, which I don't like because could use arc and use foundations, but still it's nice. Smart choice.
I thought that hint, the idea of hints itself was novel, but you're saying it's
not. No,
there's a lot of
questions. Maybe the same people, but no, in this paper.
Well, then you should certainly, I mean, if you make it generalized, then you certainly need to be specific somewhere. And I think one big question is how do you automatically, let's say, evaluate hint quality at least?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you evaluate hint quality and if you can you dynamically change your hinting mechanism to improve hint quality?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the questions that you would put in a generalized framework. I mean, if you want to generalize something to say, okay, I work with arbitrary hints, these are the questions I should answer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and how do different types of hints? Because, for instance, there they evaluate only DB2 hints, but if you have multiple applications working at the same time, they might have different types of hints.
Yeah, that's not the case here with concurrent applications.
Yeah, but only
different types of hints.
Yeah, but they do it with multiple instances of DB2. With different hint types.
Yeah, all those hint types are different, yeah. So you just say, okay, I have, instead of one set of hint types, I have two sets of hint types, and this is one big set of hints.
Yeah.
Each hint is distinct, and I treat each hint at the same level.
Yeah, but that's maybe not right.
Maybe not right, but that makes the approach work.
The other question I have is that is theory really this storage later, or can be used for anything?
Can be, sorry?
Used for anything else.
Yeah, I mean, it's the general approach that applies beyond caching.
Right.
Yeah, it probably could.
I don't know. I mean, I'm a little unconvinced about having an accept rating on this. Maybe a weak accept, but even that would be
general.
Because if hint-based approaches already exist, I don't see.
Yeah, there's already a fast paper they mentioned. 2005.
I don't know. Ricardo, what do you still think this is good?
I think it's good.
Yeah, I like it. But that doesn't mean good.
Well, I will let you know what is discussed in the program committee meeting, but my rating would probably be either a reject or a weak accept. Weak reject or a weak accept.
system, but I'm not sure. I mean, I have to look at all the papers and then I have to have a good distribution of ratings so that I'm not too many accepts and not too many rejects.
Well, actually, there's a paper called Second Tier Cash Management Using Right Teams.
Yeah, that is for
the one.
That's the one in FAST.
So which one?
That's the one they compared with, actually.
Okay. All right, so I think we have one paper remaining.
Yeah.
So let's finish it off, okay?
Okay.
Let's do quickly.
Okay, so let's go quickly.
That was a really long one.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's very clear. Also
wrong. Yeah, you can take a picture of that and make it to the user.
All right, who's the scribe on this one?
Ricardo, I think.
Second.
Okay, so this paper is called the couplet algorithm update. So I think first they motivate the paper by introducing the problem of current file systems. So they said that current file systems, they classify the file system in two types. The one they call, I don't remember how they call, but this is static file system.
Object like, update.
Object update file system. There is normal file system, a static file system like extension 2, Unix file system, and so on.
Or extension 3 as well.
Extension 3 is considered object update. All the general file systems, right. And the other one is called coupled file systems.
Coupled address update.
Coupled address update. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Coupled address update that refers to those file systems based on copy and write, like Waffle or I would say LFS or right. Okay, so I think they said one of the problems, what they are trying to improve is the consistency and performance of all these file systems. And they said one fundamental problem of the file system is that you have one-to-one mapping of a block. So I understand that if you give, if you search or you look up for a block number, then you have just one copy of that block. To solve this, they just propose to extend this function to make it instead of one to one, to make it one to two. This game. The thing is that now they develop this Kiro that I call subsystem, the Kiro subsystem. What it does is that it have a separate partition, and because now you have a mapping of one to two, then you can map one LBA in the block layer to two blocks in the physical disk, right? So so they have this additional partition that they manage, and for me this was like some kind of journal. Or a journal partition, a log partition, and based on some policies that I didn't understand very well, they decide to write directly to the original position, the file system position, or write to this log. So they also have a mapping to keep this information, and I think
so they can choose whichever position they want to write to.
So what's the goal of the system?
The goal, they said that the goal of this is to improve consistency and performance.
How would you improve consistency?
Doesn't improve consistency.
This paper made absolutely no sense to me.
Okay, yeah. Because they said, oh, this is perfect. So now you have a separate partition, and you have a file system, so because now you have a choice to write, then you have a better consistency than order more. And I don't know. I mean, it's like that. And I didn't understand what is consistency, right, is coming from. Yeah. So
my comment was that the what they call as coupled address update and decoupled address update don't
right.
solve the consistency problem.
Exactly.
They don't really solve consistency
exactly.
at all. Consistency requires you to make sure that a set of operations are atomic.
Right.
That's
and
what is really
or at least that you you can also you know have consistency if you enforce some order between blocks.
Yeah.
But even that, they said that it doesn't matter the order, you will have consistency. So that's, I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, and they say, well, they're comparing journaling with copy on write. Okay, they
right.
always compare journaling with copy on write. And this is an apples to oranges comparison.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's worse because those are at least two fruits, right?
right.
Like, I mean, what I like is like comparing a car to a steering wheel, more like that.
right, right.
Yeah, exactly.
So
you
yeah.
cannot compare journaling and copy on write. That doesn't
yeah.
make any
mm-hmm.
sense.
Yeah.
And those are like, they start with that comparison right from the first page.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I have some comments like, I didn't say that their system doesn't have a consistency, but I say more like, you can give an example where orders more fail and your system sucks. Right? Not suck.
Succeeds, yeah.
Exactly. That's what I meant. So yeah, so I said that and other than that, the other thing I didn't like is that in the evaluation they compare with extension 2 and extension 3, but they also they mentioned a lot LFS or other file systems. They didn't compare with LFS, for instance, that we have an implementation for Linux.
And what experiments did they do?
Okay, so experiments they do Postmark and Bonnie.com. So they run Postmark and Bonnie++ in extension 3 with order, full journal mode, that I guess is data, journal mode, RazorFS, extension 2 with Kiro.
It's what?
Kiro.
Kiro.
That's
Kiro.
And RazorFS without journal and Kiro. And the other thing is that they claim that this, because this is at the block layer, right? So they claim that this works with any file system that they put there. And one of my questions is even with LFS, for instance.
So when they choose which location to write, they need to have this persistent map to
yes.
to keep track of where
right.
you know which position they actually chose.
Right.
So I mean, do they talk about that additional metadata write to make it consistent?
No. They at least say that they have that it has to be persistent.
Yeah.
But they don't mention
how do you make this atomic?
No,
I mean,
they don't mention it.
But their whole point is to make a consistent file system, right?
Right.
And
so
if you cannot guarantee consistency in one of your basic mechanisms, then...
Yeah, my guess is that they mentioned something about a log record. So each time you write in a log, you have a log record. So probably in that log record, you're also writing the mapping information.
Yeah.
But they don't mention it. Explicitly.
Yeah, I think the key problem is that my suspicion is that they don't really understand what file system consistency is.
Mm-hmm.
That there are, you know, if you want to maintain a file system consistent, then you have to keep several data structures consistent at all times.
Yeah.
So updates to those related data structures have to be atomic. And I think that's what they miss when they start comparing consistency of journaling and consistency on copy on write mechanisms, which really is, you know, copy on write is just a mechanism. It doesn't guarantee any consistency.
Mm-hmm.
You had to combine copy on write with some other mechanisms for atomicity, so that you have consistency. I think that's.
Yeah. So here's my. I was, you know, how is this possible? Yes, when we incorporate the file system, we create a synchronous model of the file system. It's always chosen. Because the Kiro prototype system monitors all data updates, a block level, enforcing order updates between metadata and data is not necessary anymore.
Yeah, where was that?
7.1.
Yeah, so that's one statement that keeps occurring again and again, that copy on write, you don't need consistency or something like that. There was one...
Well, in the copy on write, if you update in the write sequence, then you will have consistency, right? Your file system will always be consistent.
If you update in the right sequence, that
would be true. Right sequence.
That would be true even in non copy on write file systems.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. Copy on write is just a mechanism, not.
I mean, to make sure that you have consistent file system, then you need to ensure that you write in the correct sequence. But they don't
talk
about sequentiality of serializing of operations.
Yeah. Yeah. So. For me, this was a sentence.
So, accept.
So, accept. A strong accept.
I think this would be
strong DJ.
Yeah.
There is
no
rating available.
Sorry, yeah.
Oh, and ask me
what? Yeah, well.
The scene.
No, but the other question I had is, how is Kiro different than logical disk? So, logical disk also...
Logical disk.
Well, basically, actually, logical disk is more of a log-structured block layer.
Okay, okay.
So, is Kiro any different than that? I guess it is, because logical disk always writes
will
in a log.
All the system.
It's always writing in a log.
Right.
And Kiro can choose wherever it wants to write.
Or the file system or the log.
Yeah, but it's a real mystery what's going on inside the author's head. Because there may be something there, but it's just not coming out in the text. You know, I want to give them the benefit of doubt, but I just cannot extract any intelligence.
What I said about the example, I think if they put some example and a convincing example, that would make the paper a lot stronger. Yeah.
So what sort of example would this be again?
Would be an example of, because they said that with their system, if you use their system, it's even more, it has a better consistency than using other mode in extension grid, right? So one of the examples that I say is that, okay.
Where do they say that? I mean, because I don't see that anywhere. Where do they say this?
I guess probably the same sentence. Because here, system, because they said that in
7.1.
Uh-huh. It's looking at forcing order of basic.
Because the Kiro prototype system monitors all updates, is that the one?
Yeah.
All data updates at the block level. Enforcing ordered updates between metadata and data is not necessary anymore.
Right.
Monitors all data updates.
So
because
that means exactly. That means that in order mode where you first write the data and then you write the metadata, it's not necessary, right? Because they have a better consistency.
So how is it better than ordered mode? I mean, they cannot be. I mean, do they have the same consistency as ordered mode?
They don't mention that. I'm assuming when they said that, it's because they are completely sure that it's perfectly consistent. So I would say that it has the same consistency as data journal mode, right? Which is the best consistency you could have. So what I'm saying is that give an example of where other mode fail, but your system doesn't. Succeed.
Ordered mode fails. But that may not be, I mean, what is, it could be that they say we have the same consistency as ordered mode.
Yeah,
and
no,
we are simpler.
I didn't find that in the paper, and they don't mention how consistent is their system.
Yeah, but if you say that, you should show us how your consistency is better than ordered mode. Maybe they are not claiming that in the first place.
That's right, but at the same time they are not saying the limitations of in that case, right? They are not saying how consistent is their system. So, well, at least for me, I assume that that consistent was the best consistency I could have, right?
So, they address cleaning?
Yes, the way they address cleaning is that they said at some point, and that's one another comment that I have. They don't say when you trigger the cleaning process. You take whatever everything is in the log and write it to the file system, and that way you clean the log.
The other partition, you mean?
Yeah, because you have two partitions, the log partition and the normal file system partition. So they said that at some point in time, you take your log, read all the log, I don't know, and update the corresponding blocks in the file.
So you do multiple writes in that case. So
you do, and that's my other claim, that they say that you are avoiding the multiple writes
in the journaling. But they need to do that, yeah.
But if you are writing again to the file system, you have the second write.
But if you instead choose to write to the file system location instead of the log, then you don't need to do multiple writes.
That's true.
Only for those data that were written in the log do you need to do multiple writes.
That's true.
And that's the usual.
But the problem is how do you have transactions? I mean, how do you ensure atomicity in the Eero file system? Because if you write to the original location, so you always enforce a certain sequence of operations that you first update the tree of the metadata.
No, because they do this at the block layer. And in some,
they don't have any semantic information.
And they don't have semantic information about what that block means.
Oh, because there is a mapping that's maintained.
Exactly. So.
And so they want to modify copy on write as it works in NetApp file system, right? So in NetApp file system, if you do copy on write.
Right.
So at the lowest level, if you want to make a copy, then you also need to make copies of. Till you go to the root of the file system,
right?
So each time you need to make a copy of
it.
Yeah,
and their goal is to eliminate all these additional copies that you need to create.
Right.
By maintaining a mapping at this layer.
Right.
The block level mapping at this layer.
Mm-hmm.
So,
why is that not fit?
That's a big question.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, because they said that they don't need to enforce an order between metadata and that, right? Which means that they most likely...
So the file system needs to do that somehow. So the file system needs to maintain that.
That's true, yeah. But they said that by using Kiro, you don't need a journaling file system. I mean, you don't need to keep a consistency at the file system level. That's what I understood. And they said that by using Kiro, your consistency will be just fine. The file system will be just fine without having to keep an order between updates to the metadata. So they basically said, you take extension to file system, add Kiro, and you are safe.
So, but extension 2 also orders the sequence of operations, right?
I don't know. I was assuming that.
Oh, it doesn't. No. So, extension 2 does not have enforced barriers after each.
Method. No, I think.
Yeah. Yes, you're right. Right. So there is no consistency there. And that's because the flushing daemon is a different one than the file system when the flushing of metadata blocks happens at a different point in time than when those metadata blocks are actually touched and they are updated. So if I want to create a new file, I modify my inodes and directory entries in memory, and then at some later point the page flushing daemon is going to write those to disk,
right.
And there is no the page
that's
flushing
that's
daemon
not
is not aware of the dependency. So that's why HT3 does not really maintain consistency. It could if it were doing the synchronous write operations, but if it does that, then the performance is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So they are saying add Kiro to ext2 and then your file system will be consistent. Wow, that would be nice. Maybe they have something here. I don't know. I mean, I'm missing it.
Yeah, I'm not convinced and not helped. Yeah, and
so
actually one of the comparison is with extension to plus Kiro. What's that?
Right now what you're saying in...
So the motivation is that ext2 is not consistent by default. Did you get that part?
Yeah.
So if I add a block layer which is whatever they are proposing, decoupled address updates block layer, then ext2 will always be consistent. I mean, that's what they are claiming. So anytime you have a system crash, it's fine because
the file system will still be consistent. Which doesn't have consistency mechanism
will be consistent with
if they use this.
How can that be? So let's say you wrote a inode before you wrote, let's say you wrote an indirect block before you wrote the corresponding data block. Then you'll have a corrupt file system. Now Kiro cannot help in that.
No, Kiro cannot help. Yeah. No, because if you write...
It doesn't have that semantic.
Yeah, it doesn't have the high level. So,
I don't know what this guy was talking about.
So what, Kiro is a file system?
No, Kiro is a
block
subsystem at the block layer.
It's like
Exos. So, for instance, Exos, we guarantee the... yeah, because it's the same idea, but for something else. Well, with some meditation. But you have a mapping. So.
No, this is, you see that there is a lot of work at the block layer, right? I mean, just to point out.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting. There's more and more work in the block layer. People find it easy to operate at the block layer.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Okay, so what is the rating?
Reject.
Reject because we have no idea what you're talking about.
Exactly. The second review is...
On your opinion?
I don't think it deserves something.
Ricardo, but you always argue in favor of paper. What happened?
No, why?
You really didn't like this one.
So I don't know if I have more comments.
You didn't like it, but no. You didn't like it because you didn't understand what they were talking about, or you thought you understood and you didn't agree with them.
No, I think having the idea of multiple copies, I don't think it's an idea that deserves something.
No, but do you agree with the idea in the first place?
I don't even the idea that I think is the idea.
So you're not sure that I
agree.
Okay.
You don't know what the idea is.
Yeah.
So do you think the idea you think they are doing
it deserves
and but guarantee consistency or not?
No.
Okay.
No, he doesn't understand the idea, so there's no way he can argue about what the idea does. I mean, neither do I understand the idea.
Yeah.
Probably that is what you're talking about.
But I think I understand. My feeling is that the authors have a fundamental lack of understanding of what consistency means.
Probably they are talking about this construct that you have at the block layer. That when you write a block in a position, then you retrieve the same block. That's probably what they think is consistency.
And also the performance, right? Because you have to write it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the performance is fine because you can do that in a synchronous way. I mean, you write to the lock and you say to the file system, okay, this write is done. And that will be, if you write in a lock, to a lock will be a lot faster than writing to a position in the file system. But my big problem was the consistency. Well, among other comments.
I mean, for instance, the patches work was quite novel, I think, where you explicitly specify the dependencies and allow the flushing daemon to be aware of those dependencies when it performs the flushing of the data from memory. That was quite neat. Okay, so.